welcome to the American Cinema Foundation Movie Podcast. I am your host, Titus, and today in our European series, I am joined by Miles Smith to talk about Il Gatto Pardo, the leopard, as we say in the English translation, the film rather than the novel, although I suppose we'll talk about the novel of Giovanni Tomasi di Lampedusa as well. Gatto Pardo was a great success in 63. It won the Palme d'Or. It was a big hit in Europe and not as much in America, however. And it became almost as famous as the novel, which was suddenly had become the biggest bestseller in Italian history in 1958 upon launching 5 years earlier. So this was somehow very important for Italians, especially, but for Europeans, moreover, as a reflection on the transformation of aristocracy into the bourgeoisie, the coming of modernity, the democracy. And of course, for artists, it became a reflection on the end of the age of beauty and splendor, and a question about what the place of art in modern life would be instead. And so Miles and I are going to be talking about all of these things, talking through the movie. But first, Miles, it's your first time on the podcast, so please introduce yourself to our audience and then tell us how come you fell in love with Gatto Pardo.
Yeah, thank you, Tez. I'm Miles Smith. I'm an assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. I teach mostly American history, but I also do Latin America. I have been devoted to this film for almost going on 20 years now. I fell in love with it. I'm from the American South. I was reared in North Carolina, but I went to college in South Carolina, in Charleston, Charleston, South Carolina, which is a lovely place. And so it's very, very much sort of histories in the air in Charleston. And I was interested in nationalist movements in my undergraduate studies. And so I learned about the Italian Risorgimento, and that was sort of my gateway to discovering Lampedusa's novel, which was published posthumously in 1958. What's compelling is that the novel was turned down by the two leading publishing houses in Italy, and it was sort of found a home in a sort of a less prestigious press, but it quickly became, it's easily the best selling modern historical novel in Italian history, and is actually sold more, I think, now than Alessandro Manzoni's Promesso Sposi, The Betrothed. And so those two novels kind of bookend the sort of the great era of Italian fiction that existed in the 19th century and then the 20th century. And so the novel's compelling, I think, for Europeans and for Italians in particular, and even perhaps more particularly for people from Sicily and Neapolitans. But as an American, I was sort of entranced by it because I think it mapped so neatly onto some of the changes that happened in the United States in the same era. It's interesting that Italy unifies in the same month span that the Confederacy forms. And so I was, you know, living in Charleston and kind of very aware of Southern history. And so there's sort of an analogous story that's told in a book like Gone with the Wind. You see something very similar. And so it's been compared to sort of Italy's Gone with the Wind. It's a better book than Gone with the Wind because it's a shorter book, and it's not quite so melodramatic. It's a brooding book. Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa was a serious man, a grave person, and I don't always think a happy person. But the novel he's given us really shows, as you mentioned, the end of an era and the beginning of one. There's this amazing, amazing line that the Prince of Salina gives in the end of the book. And he says, "For everything to stay the same, everything must change." And so there's all sorts of questions you can confront about it, questions of continuity and social change. Your point's really well taken, the end of aristocracy. And what did that mean? Do we have a new aristocracy in our bourgeois era? Who are the new aristocrats? Are they aristocrats? And so it's a novel that hits on so many different things, and it's just a beautiful novel. The characters are so finely wrought. But there's also humor in it. It's also it's a sort of a charming book in some way, because there's lighthearted moments, and one thinks of when the dawn arrives wearing tails for what is a fairly simple family supper at the palace in Donna Fugata. And so it's a magnificent film. The book is important, but the film did something I think the book couldn't do, which was offer the story to an even larger audience. By casting an American in the lead role, Luchino Visconti made a decision that I think he was actually somewhat criticized for in Italy at the time, but I think gave the film a broader reach, at least in the viewership, than it might have had. So it's a magnificent movie. For any of your listeners who haven't seen it, you should go watch it. Don't watch the American version. Don't watch the dub version. Watch it, the long uncut version in Italian, because it's essential to hear it. It's a movie that needs to be heard as much as it does to be watched.
I think so. And also, in an unusual
move, when they made the American version, they didn't just cut too much out of it, but they also used an inferior color processing. And so it just doesn't look as beautiful.
And the color is so important. You think of the ball scene, the ballroom scene, which is perhaps one of the greatest scenes in any film in history. All the color that you really need to have to make that scene work. So absolutely, that's a great point.
The entire ballroom scene is lit by candles that they had to keep replacing because candles run out. And so it was an ordeal from one point of view. But on the other hand, when you see it, you get to appreciate all the light, all the shadows, all the nuances, the warmth, intimacy, as well as the sense that this is maybe slightly creepy. The end of an era, indeed. So the film does bring out a lot of the intention of the novel, not just in a way that's better for the cinema age, for the world of democracy, the mass audience, but maybe it just adds passion that the novel lacks. I think that's perhaps because the author Lampedusa was himself the last prince of Lampedusa, and perhaps therefore he spoke or wrote with some of the reserve that was typical of that world and is not typical of ours. And so our access might require something like the direction of Visconti, who insists on the beauty of the figures, the landscapes, but perhaps beyond that, on the statuesque quality, the moral seriousness, the impressive quality, the almost stone-faced Burt Lancaster, who was, of course, a good get. He was a star. It made the film a lot more attractive, especially in America, but perhaps around the world. It made it attractive to the producers in the first place. A lot of money came into the production. But he contributed something impressive. And I think it's on the strength of this that in his own Novecento, Bertolucci hired him to play the estate nobleman Berlingeri the following decade. So Lancaster ended up making a few movies in Europe. And I think it showed what a wonderful screen presence he had. And, you know, he was sometimes in his earlier years derided as a cowboy actor. But I think that too might point out that there's a certain connection between cowboys and the aristocracy.
Yes, very much. I think that Burt Lancaster is... Casting Lancaster was interesting because he was not only an American, he was Protestant from a Scots-Irish background. But I think your point's really well taken. There's some important connection between the idea of a Sicilian aristocrat and a cowboy, or we might say a frontiersman. One thinks of the scene where the prince goes hunting with the town organist. And it's a very martial, masculine scene. He kind of roughs up the organist, and they sort of have this spat. And there's sort of a masculinity that you see could be mapped very much onto a figure like an Andrew Jackson, a figure very consistent with the American frontier. So Burt Lancaster, Scots-Irish, is able to bridge that in such a way to make it presentable to Americans, but also he's a believable Italian prince. And so casting him is, I think, one of those decisions. I don't even know if they knew what they were getting when they made the decision. And perhaps that was the same too for what was then a young Alain Delaine and Claudia Cardinale too. Both of them sort of at the beginning of their careers, neither of them had had their big break yet. And so the film's 1963, I think, is when most of the principal photography is done at the beginning of 1963. So the casting decisions, I wonder even if Visconti understood what he was getting when that was happening.
This was an era in European cinema when a lot of American money was floating around, a lot of American producers, and international productions were in vogue. Look, Visconti, like most of the cast in the production, this is Italy, but they get an American actor, and his co-star is this French guy, Alain Delon, who was already acting in Italian movies and made some other movies with Visconti. Rocco and His Brothers is famous. So there was quite a lot of international co-production, especially between France and Italy, but to some extent Germany as well. So it was not unusual. It would be a lot more unusual now. It was not unusual at the time. Burt Lancaster spoke in English, but then they had an Italian dub him. In fact, the Italian lady, Claudia Cardinale, was also dubbed for because she doesn't sound quite as dainty as they judge the character to need to sound. And of course, Alain Delon was dubbed. And that made it meant that there would be an Italian version, but there would also be an English version in which everybody else was dubbed. So that's how these things were made. There was quite a bit of improvisation, but quite a bit of enterprise. And maybe this is the greatest of all of those movies made in the era of co-productions. So let's try to get to the story. I think the summary of the plot is going to be very, very quick. Il Gattopardo is a story of the Risorgimento of the National Union. The Prince Salinas, Don Fabrizio, is watching his country being conquered by the red shirts of Giuseppe Garibaldi. These are Republicans, they are enthusiasts, they are really men of the stamp of 1848, the era of romantic revolutions. But it's only now coming in earnest to Italy, 48 having been an abortive 5 days in Milano. In that part of the world. So he looks at the world change in front of him. He notices that his young nephew, his favorite, the man he hopes would inherit after him, the one in whom he sees his own manliness and charm and love of women and dominant tendencies, played by Alain Delon, of course, Tancredi, named for the, I guess, the crusader. So Don Fabrizio sees Tancredi become a revolutionary, join the Risorgimento, join Garibaldi, actually fight under him as Sicily is being conquered, which somewhat shocks him since they are by profession aristocrats, not to say by birth. But he accepts. He is, on the one hand, a man of science, we learn. He an astronomer and clearly very well educated. And on the other hand, a man of a certain resignation that he associates somehow with the land. Sicily has been conquered for so many thousands of years, and yet it is still there. So why fight this one? And then we get the plebiscite, the National Assembly, the declaration for union with what was then the Kingdom of Sardinia and Piemonte, and eventually became Italy. And the prince begins his long retreat. He takes the family to the summer residence in Donnafugata, up in the hills where the weather is more pleasant, and they wait out the torrid sun and hope for the rain to come. And he accepts further that his nephew, Tancredi, married the beautiful Angelica, the daughter of Don Calogero, who is the most important man in town and the biggest owner in the new situation, the man who rigged the vote in the plebiscite. And indeed, the future, when men from the kingdom, a guy called Chevalier, comes to ask the prince to serve in the new National Senate as a great aristocrat and man of renown and as well as of enlightenment, he refuses and says, you should want Don Calogero instead. If you need senators for a new regime, get men of the new regime. And then we finally see the great ball where Angelica is introduced into society, that is to say, into the very small aristocratic class of Palermo in Sicily. And so the story is about how this man oversees his own succession. He will be replaced by this nephew whom he loves and of whom he's nevertheless critical. And he sees that that nephew cannot marry into his family, but must marry into money and the politics of the new regime. He even accepts the way in which Tancredi and everybody else involved betray Garibaldi for the kingdom once Garibaldi's republicanism becomes unbearable to the northern aristocracy. So they shift allegiances twice, but it all leads to this new regime. And yet it's haunted by this statement, for everything to stay the same, everything must change. And that's somehow what the movie is about. Is there a perspective from which a man of this moral seriousness and education could figure out that the modernization of Italy is not going to be such a success? And maybe it doesn't even deserve to be. So that's the oddity of the movie. Visconti was by no means a man of the right. In fact, he was a man of the left. And he is himself the descendant of the great ducal family of Milano of low 6 centuries back or so, before they were usurped by the Sforzas in the age of Machiavelli, let's say. But he's not a man of the left, and yet he has an incredible sensitivity to this great character, to his vision of his world changing. And he clearly hit upon something about why even people in a modern democracy where nobody would applaud or obey a man so used to command as Don Fabrizio is, nevertheless cannot take their eyes off of him.
There's a moving scene during the plebiscite vote where the vote happens, and the vote is not done through the private ballot. It's of course Guasciotti, and so the prince votes yes on the referendum, and then he's given a choice. The Don Caligero has a tray of liqueurs. Tice, you'll remember this scene. This tray of liqueurs, and one is red, one is white, and one is green through the colors of the Italian tricolor, and the prince takes the white one in the middle, and the other voters, many of whom are middle class, kind of start whispering amongst themselves, and they say, "Ah, one last homage to the Bourbons, the Bourbon monarchy that's being replaced." And so there's this fascination with the aristocrats that no one can get away from. Everything they do is sort of looked at. There's a palpable sense that there's something being lost. And I think of there, the best analog is something like the dinosaurs is they're dead. They're in a completely different era, and yet we're fascinated by them. The same thing I think goes for monarchy today and for the lingering aristocrats in Europe. I know that I teach in a college campus, and Eduard Habsburg is who is on Twitter, is a favorite of some of our students. And he's a fairly normal, he's a relatively conservative. He works for a conservative government, but a relatively normal guy. He talks about his kids, he talks about his service, and yet students are fascinated by him. And why is that? Well, because he's a Habsburg, and there's magic that goes with it. And I think you see that Lampedusa capture that sense of magic in the book, but Visconti actually takes it a bit further because we can see it. And we've been able to see kind of that magic work with the servants, with someone like the town organist who works in the cathedral, huntsmen's, everybody who interacts with them. There's always that magic. And the movie makes that visible in a way. You can actually tell. I think of the scene where they arrive in Donna Fugata and there's a service held for them. And the princely family walks in and there's sort of a hush and everybody's watching them. And so Visconti's ability to pull that off in a way that didn't seem sensational, because as much as there's the magic, there's also a sense that these are very normal people. They come in, there's dust on their clothes, they're having to wipe themselves off. They're not actually magic, right? They're people who get dusty and who don't like to travel. And so the film gives the audience a chance to sort of look at, yes, the magic of aristocracy, but also the reality of their lives too.
Yeah, it seems like that's one of the major differences. In the novel, you get to a very large extent the thoughts, the ruminations of the prince. In the movie, you see much more of what the world looks like to him and how the world looks at him. And of course, the
Yes.
extent to which the world still turns around him. I suppose that's partly what is so interesting. He is a man used to commanding, he is a man who is very comfortable. among people he expects to rule. And that obviously is not possible in our situation. But of course, we do nevertheless always yearn for such men to arrive. And it is part of the oddity of American life that and if you look at the list of American presidents, mostly there are a lot of non-entities, these mediocre people who had public spirit. And if the times were good, they were quite made quite a good impression. But also, you know, led the country to all of its bad times in their different successions. And then you get six men maybe who are astonishing or clearly on a different scale and who seem like they were born to lead America through its great crisis. That's something of what the electorate goes through, what people feel about Trump on that side, or what people felt about Obama on that side. So it's still a very real experience. And this is what the everybody in the movie feels about Don Fabrizio.
I think that this idea of men sort of rising to the occasion, Tancredi is one of those. And yet the film leaves you morally feeling quite ambiguous towards Tancredi. Perhaps in a way that people don't feel ambiguous about the prince himself. There's a very short scene. It's my understanding Visconti didn't like war movies. And so he has really only about a 7 or 8 minute clip of the Garibaldini entering Palermo. And Tancredi's in the fight and he's one of the soldiers. And so there's something admirable about that, but he doesn't dwell on that. So if we think of like a George Washington who is a military man who rises to the occasion, and there's a sort of magic that goes with that. That's not the case for this Italian writer or this Italian filmmaker. There's an ambiguity to Tancredi that there isn't for the prince. We almost, as we watch the film, seem a more reasonable man in this pacific, almost, dare I say, anti-militarist prince, that leaves us perhaps more taken with him than we are with Tancredi. There is no magic about Tancredi. Even his decision to fight with the Garibaldini makes him more common. And that's, we don't do that with our own revolution, but Visconti felt that for the 1860 invasion of Sicily. So that's something when I talk about with students, that's something comes up quite a bit, is Tancredi's a war hero, and yet we're left feeling ambivalent toward him. There's nothing particularly heroic about his war service. There's something more heroic about the prince living as a prince as the world changes. And I think that's one of those lessons from the film, if I can say there's lessons in the film, that we don't reflect on enough, perhaps Americans wouldn't reflect on enough.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And the novel turns on this distinction. Maybe in the new world, nobody will be as big as Don Fabrizio is in the old world. He has this famous line that in the past, there were lions and servals, I guess is the name of the animal. We translate the Gattopardo that way. It's a small feline, smaller than a cheetah even. Maybe like a bobcat, maybe like a lynx, but still impressive. But in the new days, he says there will be jackals and hyenas. Mm-hmm. It's his judgment on the inevitable modern society. And I think that explains one aspect of our romanticism or nostalgia. That is, there is something deeply immoral in some of the modern successes. One often feels that it's about what you can get away with. Another difference is that Don Fabrizio inherited his titles and properties, whereas the poor Tancredi has to shift for himself. And there is a lot more ugliness at the origins of wealth and authority than later when you can inherit it. That's also true. But there are other differences. Tancredi does seem to be simply unable to understand anything tragic. He does not think that there is anything lost, for example, in the defeat of Garibaldi. He's merely a little ashamed, say, that he's reminded that he used to be on the red shirt side. It's not possible for him to think, you know, that was actually a different Republican destiny for Italy that was opened briefly by Garibaldi and disappeared. He doesn't have any tragic sense, which the prince has in spades. So that's yet another distinction between them. But Tancredi does seem to show modern Italy with all of its charms, all of its love of beauty, all of its sensuality. These are qualities that the prince also possesses and must have possessed them even more so in his own youth. But other things separate them. Tancredi is not ever pious. The prince makes shows of piety throughout the movie, even though, like many men, chafes under the rule of priests and of pious women, and of course under the strictures of the church. It's a very Italian and a very Catholic story, so it's much more emphatic in its symbols and in its demands. Another difference between the prince and his heir, Tancredi, is a political calculator and a moneymaker. It's a way in which I guess the character fits the occasion. Modern people have to be that way. Money does matter a lot more when you can't inherit property, or the property you inherit is something you have to always pay taxes on. So it's a situation that requires that men not think too much of themselves. Think more of how to make ends meet, think more about how to meet their fiduciary duties, if you want to put it that way. But if there's money left at the end of the month, that's pretty good, is another way of putting it. So the smallness of the man is somehow required so that there's room for everybody else. Whereas, of course, in the aristocratic world, there is a conflict between the church and the prince. Although the prince's best friend is his father confessor, the priest, Father Pirone,
the only one educated enough, too.
Exactly. And then, so, you know, after the banishment of the Jesuits and their return after the French Revolution and so on, he's an educated man. He's the only one he can really have a conversation with. And also because he's the only one whose authority is somehow autonomous of the authority of the prince, although he knows not to press his luck. So the prince and the priest have that in common too. They have a certain caution and good manners, and the two are not really separable. These are not options for Tancredi, and it's not clear that they're options for people in the modern world so long as they want success. Because a certain degree of recklessness and bad manners is just mandatory. And so Tancredi conceals all of that behind his charm, and we love his beautiful wife, though presumably not as much as he does. But these are all necessary concealments of a character that is not lovely, as you were suggesting, indeed.
Yeah. I think that you brought up this good point earlier that Tancredi has no sense of the tragic. There's something nearly Augustinian about Fabrizio. One thinks of this tension between him and his own religiosity, that the opening scene, the very first scene of the book, there's a dead Bourbon soldier, a dead soldier of what that would have been, Francis II, King of the Two Sicilies. And the family is at prayer when the soldier is found, and the priest is going through the missal, the litany in the missal, and he's beginning another round of it. And the prince takes his prayer book, you'll remember this, Titus, and slams it shut. And then the priest sort of said, okay, I guess we're done. And so there's this piety there, but it's also very much piety on the prince's terms. And so you see him do almost everything on this kind of, admittedly, very imperfect terms. Tancredi has to have everything sort of be the best. And by best, what I mean is there's sort of an idealization of perfection and victory that he thinks he can achieve. It's funny that Tancredi, who I don't think is meant to be seen as admirable as the prince, is much more of a one-woman man. He's completely taken with Angelica, and we don't have any sniff of him sort of having a mistress on the side, which the Fabrizio very much has a mistress that he goes and visits down in town. And so I think there's this question then, which of these men is admirable? In 1860s in the United Kingdom and in Italy, you had the adoption of bourgeois values as being sort of the ideal. And the prince is completely not interested in those. Tancredi is adopting them because that's his ticket to success. There's even a scene where when Angelica first comes to dinner, she laughs in this very unguarded, very completely improper kind of way of laughing, and everyone's sort of taken aback, and the prince is taken aback too, but to sort of smooth the way for his nephew, he sort of chuckles, right? It's his way of sort of adopting his bourgeois values into the aristocracy, and so those tensions make the prince, I think, a more interesting character than he might have otherwise been, and so all of that leads you to the question of, okay, which is admirable, the old order or our new order that's replacing it, and it's a valuable question, because I think Lampedusa was asking that for himself. He had lived through the Second World War. He was dying as he was writing the book, of course, dying of lung cancer. And so I think Visconti, who is not a man of the right either, Visconti is asking his own question about Italy in the middle of the 20th century. And that the novel and the movie don't give us perhaps the answers we might want, or even a clear answer, but they're still so necessary to watch. If for no other reason, it gives you the idea that people are always aware of these questions. These aren't just sort of historical automatons. They're persons and actors who are making decisions in time and in space. Then Prince Fabrizio is making his own decisions in time and space, and perhaps not the ones he thought he would make.
Yeah, there's something about the character, his great reflection, that matches the author himself, who is in a way telling the story of his grandfather, of the family authority being wasted away as the country modernized, but therefore also the story of the country. And it's worth noticing that the 19th century really was the century of progress. All of the great transformations of the modern world, the modern city, the modern party systems and elections and so on, democracy. It was part of that as much as experimental science and the new industrial power based on technology and increasingly globalized commerce. But that led fairly quickly to the Great War. In Italy, that led to fascism, partly because it didn't seem like the country was governable. It didn't seem like the monarchic representative regime really had the power to govern or to keep the civil peace, the World War I. Nor, on the other hand, did it seem like the people were really in love with this increasingly secular, increasingly liberal order. And so there was a terrible political conflict in the kingdom. In that sense, the distinction between the elder Don Fabrizio and the younger Tancredi is also supposed to make people think about what happened with the kings of Italy, what happened with Mussolini, what happened with the plebiscite to end the kingdom and proclaim a republic and this new founding of the political order. Now, obviously, this is not quite as easy to transfer to America as it was with the Risorgimento and the Civil War, because America did not have these kinds of political crises in the 20th century, and indeed has a just much longer constitutional tradition that's really unperturbed. As ancient as Sicily is, it's not politically durable in the way in which the American Constitution has proved so far. So you see, in a way, these two aspects of politics. In a way, America is a very new place. In a way, it's the oldest constitutional order, and both are very important. Sicily and Italy are the other way around. It's somehow always been there, thousands and thousands of years. But political order is not particularly their strong suit. And so presumably there is something in this very aristocratic attitude of the prince that ordinary people identify with, that their first affections don't go to a constitutional order, whichever one that might be.
I think there's this question. You think about the plebiscite scene, and then the obvious understanding that there's developing. There's a new broadly liberal order that's being imposed by the Savoyard kings of Sardinia. And even as much as that order exists, you get the sense in the film that the prince will still be something there of that old aristocratic order. It's almost like constitutions can't annihilate custom, no matter how much we think they can. And I think that's something that Lampedusa senses, and obviously lived through right? The fact that there was, right, this imposition of a constitution in 1848 in Sardinia by Carlo Alberto, and in the 1861, it becomes the Kingdom of Italy, and it's sort of imposed on Italy. And then there's tinkering throughout the end of the 19th century, and much something more substantive than tinkering in the 20th with the rise of the black shirts and the rise of fascism. But the Italians can't get away from being Italians. So the custom of the country endures, even as there's new constitutions and new laws and new regimes. I think I was reading something about the mafioso in Sicily and how that endured until the 1990s, when there's a concentrated effort by the Italian state to put it down. But even still, it lingers. You can't ever get away. Can't totally get away from those things. And I think that's what the Leopard's all about. It's a film that asked us to see, okay, how much can we get away from ourselves, and no matter how hard we try. And so, yeah, it really is a brilliant film in that sense. And it shows you things endure. The ball scene, all the Piedmontese officers come, and they're the new order, and yet they're kind of taken with this ball that the prince has put on. They're in their resplendent blue uniforms, and yet they're all sort of taken with what's happening there in that ballroom in Donna Fugata. So,
yeah, it seems like it's easier when you point to the old aristocratic order to say, as with Don Fabrizio, these were men, but also as with the arrangement, that they're somehow aware of permanent things in human character and of the dependence of all human things on non-human things. And both of these things have been lost. The movie, like the novel, gives great images for the novel and for the protagonist, Don Fabrizio's insistence that Sicilians are the way they are because Sicily is the way it is. They are creatures of the land. It is astonishingly fertile, and therefore they are sensual to a point where maybe only a strict Catholicism can put a bridle on them. But on the other hand, they're also resigned to the power of the sun, to the endless, long, rainless summer, that they just have to survive, but it saps the life out of them. The tyranny of the climate, the tyranny of the sun is the source of their character. And since it's always been this way, it always will be this way. There's not something that the political order can change. It's only the northern representative who thinks, but look at the poverty of the people, you know, that can be ameliorated. Surely as a good ruler of your people, you want what's good for them and would strive to improve their condition. The prince doesn't think in those terms. And if you look at Sicily now, yeah, it's still like the south of Italy, a lot poorer than the north. A lot of these changes that were supposed or promised have certainly not materialized. And whether it's popular indolence or bad government or a combination of the two, throw in the mafia, other things, the world wars, there's a lot of reasons. But the fact is also as massive as those reasons, or more massive. So maybe the prince was right. At any rate, it's something worth contemplating, because it's tied up somehow with his notion that you should look at the world and square with the fact that you will die. Your power to change things, even just to make sure you'll always be around, is in fact very limited. That seems somehow to be part of the power he exercises, and the power the movie exercises over the audience. A hint that some things are permanent, and when we look at those things, we are to some extent sobered up. It's not exactly the beauty of our hopes. It's the beauty of the things to which we have to resign ourselves. It's sort of like why it's much more likely that adults will start taking up hobbies of looking at the world around them than children who just go through it. Because whenever you look at those trees or landscapes or whatever it is that speaks to your heart, I guess in America it's going to be the Grand Canyon, the something in the Rocky Mountains, the oceans, these infinitely powerful things that you have absolutely no grasp on. It's that sublime thing. Whenever you look at that, you realize your mortality, your weakness. And that's a very hard thing to square with. And it seems like, to the extent to which the prince is a prince, is because he has that mastery over himself, not over his society, which he can let go of as a new order is installed.
I think the idea of self-government is valuable because the prince is self-governing in a way that probably makes Americans uncomfortable. Tancredi is much more, would be the hero for the Americans, but that's not who's presented as truly heroic. The coda of the book is interesting because you have the prince's daughters and they are relatively unchanged. Lampedusa leaves us with this. It's not in the film, of course, or it's not in the film the same way as is in the book. And I've always wondered why. What was the decision behind that? And so I don't know. And the principals aren't with us anymore to ask. But it's just a magnificent film, and I don't think it gets I don't think it has the broad base appeal that it might have a few years ago. But I think it's coming back. I'm on my campus. I mention it a lot to students, and once they discover it, they're usually entranced by it. So I think there's definitely a viewership for it amongst the Zoomer generation, I guess we call them. They like pretty things and they're interested in that which is durable. And I think The Leopard presents a picture of something that's uniquely durable, even as the world changed around it.
Yeah, somehow to say, you know, to repeat again, for everything to stay the same, everything must change. Does it mean that Tancredi and the New Order will rule, but he's enough like his uncle? Does it mean that, in fact, the Italian character you find in Sicily is going to endure despite all the political change? It seems to mean both and other things besides. But for it fundamentally to make sense, it means that there has to be something that doesn't change in a standard by which, a frame in relation to which you can notice everything else changing. It's not possible otherwise to tell that things are changing. It's not a matter of do you like the change or are you very perspicacious, but how can you even notice change except in relation to something that does not change? And so that's somehow what is at stake in the drama of the film and in the character of its protagonist, and why it has to be the Prince Fabrizio, not the up-and-coming successful politician, wealthy Tancredi. The latter doesn't really have an inkling about what he's sacrificing. That's why he's so beautiful and charming and has so much fun. But of course, I think you're right. In our times, people are looking for splendor as possibly a guess at a sense of a grasp of something that is permanent. And that has to do with how many delusions of progress have been dashed, how many promises have been lost. And yet people would like some awareness of what it means to be a man, as in the Tom Wolfe novel, A Man in Full. That's what it would seem that Don Fabrizio is.
Now that's an interesting comparison. And Charlie Coker is a character that I think weds a lot of the tensions of Tancredi and the prince. That would be a wonderful comparison to do A Man in Full and The Leopard together, because Charlie Coker is the new man at the end of his life, or towards, you know, who's now aged and is disillusioned in so many ways. So wow, that's something I haven't thought about. There's an essay in that for sure. So
maybe, you know, we'll talk about Tom Wolfe and his novels in other podcasts.
Absolutely.
There's a man who thought about stoicism and the need for men as a judgment on the times or a frame. So it's still with us somehow. Well, for now, Miles, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure, and I hope we have offered something provocative to people in comparing the Union of Italy with Civil War in America and the Union triumphant, and that we have also offered something provocative with this notion of princely figure who can find in himself the standards by which to judge the world and the transformation of regimes. But maybe there's something in being human that's, for example, independent of political conflict or goes beyond it. And with that, let us close our conversation for now, and all the best until next we chat.